Well, Andrew, you had an introduction, but you are, of course, one of our leading historians, one of our leading historical biographers. You talked to everyone who'd ever come across Churchill, it seemed, and who's still alive, and you went to all the places you went to. And you used new documents. So what have these told you that you didn't already know?
Well, one of the reasons that I went to all these places is that my wife loves holidays. and so it gave us a wonderful excuse to go all sorts of places around the world, because Churchill was a great traveller and went around the world a lot. But with regard to the documentary sources, I was tremendously... I'd love to pretend that it was archival genius, but actually it was very largely just pure luck that the Queen allowed me to be the first Churchill biographer to work on her father's diaries. And the wonderful thing was that King George VI and Winston Churchill, although they didn't get on very much at the beginning, because, of course, Churchill had supported his elder brother, King Edward VIII, and in the abdication crisis. And also, the king didn't really trust Churchill because of any number of reasons to do with Churchill's career. And was also very much a supporter of Neville Chamberlain's policy of appeasement. And so they could have failed to get on, but even by the end of the fall of France, before the Battle of Britain, they became friends, a word used by the king. And the great thing was that after September 1940, they sat down and had lunch together every single Tuesday of the rest of the war, and Churchill completely trusted the king. He knew that he was one of the only people in public life who wasn't after his job. And he trusted the king and liked him, and trusted him with the ultra secrets, with the nuclear secrets, and the king wrote down everything. And so we can now see what Churchill was thinking every Tuesday of the war. So that was one fantastic and very exciting for me new source. Another was Ivan Maisky's diaries, the Soviet ambassador at the time. Another one was the verbatim accounts of the war cabinet. Another one was the 41 sets of papers that have been deposited at Churchill College, Cambridge, which is including Mary Soames, Churchill's daughter's, Mary Soames' 1940 diary, which has all sorts of wonderful, lovely, rather moving views of her father. And so we were really... it's extraordinary that in the last 10 years such major sources should come. I also was very fortunate to have exclusive access to Pamela Harriman's love letters. And Pamela Harriman had a very active romantic life in the Second World War. She was, of course, she had a baby by her husband, Randolph Churchill, but also she had love affairs with Averell Harriman, her later husband, and FDR's envoy. Ed Murrow, the great American journalist, General Kevin Anderson, Sir Charles Portal, the head of the RAF, an American Air Force general, someone who all we know is by his signature, Jerry. Don't know who Jerry is, sadly. Although I had exclusive access to Pamela Harriman's love letters, no one had exclusive access to her.
That's almost a Churchillian level of repartee. We're going to talk about that later, but before we do, I think you ought to explain to us why you chose your subtitle, Walking with Destiny. What was destiny for a politician? What was destiny for Churchill? What did he understand by it?
It's absolutely epicentral to understanding Churchill. He had this... The quotation, of course, comes from the famous remark that he made in his war memoirs about the day he became Prime Minister on the 10th of May, 1940. That morning, Hitler had unleashed Blitzkrieg on the West and had invaded Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg. And in the evening, the king made him prime minister. And he wrote of that time, "I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past life were but a preparation for this hour and for this trial." And so this idea of destiny was absolutely central to him. He had believed all his life, ever since he was a 16-year-old schoolboy, that he was going to save Britain, save London in particular, he mentioned, and save the empire. And he had this this extraordinary sense. I mean, whether we believe in the concept theologically of destiny really doesn't matter at all, because Churchill did, and it gave him immense calmness in crises.
De Gaulle was a bit like that too, but De Gaulle was very religious. Churchill was not religious in any recognisable sense.
In the 5.2 million words he spoke in public speeches and the 6.2 million words that he wrote in his books and articles, he never used the word Jesus Christ once. However, he did believe in the Almighty. And of course, he had survived so many close brushes with death all the way through his life. And it strikes me that actually the primary duty of the Almighty in his world sphere was to look after Winston Churchill.
And he was quite willing to seek danger deliberately.
Absolutely. He didn't need to go to the Cuban insurrection against the Spanish, for example. And actually, when you go to, you mentioned my going to Cuba, when you go to the jungle battlefields that he went to in the middle of Cuba, which are entirely unchanged, you realise that it was a very unpleasant, scrubby, insurrectional, guerrilla war. And he didn't need to be there, but he went out of his way to go. He kept putting himself forward for various exhibitions on the Northwest frontier that his regiment weren't involved in the slightest. He got himself attached as a supernumerary lieutenant to the charge of the 21st Lancers, not his regiment either. He went in the First World War into no man's land no fewer than 30 times. He was a lieutenant colonel. He could have spent his time back at battalion headquarters, but he didn't because he was... because he was Winston Churchill, and he knew that needed to be all the time. You see it at the Sydney Street Siege, you see it in Antwerp in the First World War, and certainly in the Blitz, of course, in the Second World War. He needed to be at the place at the time. It sort of drew him magnetically to be where it really mattered to be.
He said himself, I think he wrote to his mother, that he was sometimes playing to the gallery in his youth. He'd got to become famous as a brave and decorated soldier. But this keeps up, as you say, during the First World War and indeed during the Second, when he's very keen to expose himself as much as he can to enemy fire. And of course, there's the famous, not clash, but difference of opinion with the king when the king stops him from going to D-Day. But later on, as you show, he goes to the Rhine. And he's within range of enemy artillery, and he wants to be in danger. Why is that?
And in Italy as well, of course. Yes. Italy in 1944, he went to the front line. I think part of it was that he yearned to kill a German in the Second World War. he really did. He kept a Bren gun in the back of his car, his official car at number 10, made sure that he had a Bren gun at every available opportunity. When he went on these long journeys abroad, incredibly brave of him to have gone, he covered 110,000 miles during the Second World War. And when he was in... on a ship, he made sure that his lifeboat had a machine gun attached, so that if the ship was actually sunk by a U-boat, he would be able to fire at the U-boat. He carried his Webley 32 when he went to France. And then this marvelous moment when the Ministry of Information sent him a speech that he should make when Britain was invaded. And he bristled at this anyway, because he knew perfectly well that he'd be writing the speech rather than the Ministry of Information. And you can see it in the Cambridge archives. He crosses it all out and crosses it all out. And the last words that he was going to use were "we invaded" in his great broadcast was, "The time has come, kill the Hun."
I guess we often think of him as this rather, later in life, as this rather roly-poly, sybaritic figure who has breakfast in bed and goes around in a velvet romper suit and so on. But he was pretty physically tough, wasn't he, throughout his life? I mean, as you say, he actually rode to hounds at the age of 74. He'd been a polo player
up to the age of 52.
Is this physical toughness an important part of what keeps him going?
I think so. He enjoyed pig sticking. Well, it was one of his. He was a big game hunter, of course. He was somebody who very much connected with Theodore Roosevelt's idea of the physical life. Mm. And as you say, it isn't right, even in his 70s, he would go out hunting. So it's not right to think of him as being too sybaritic. I mean, he did, of course, adore his alcohol and life's pleasures, and he always wore silk next to his skin and all of that kind of thing. But when it came to roughing it, he could do that too.
You mentioned his drinking, and of course many people, including the enemy, accused him of being a drunk. But you show, I think, pretty convincingly that this was simply not the case.
I think I agree with his own estimation when I look at it, that that alcohol was his servant rather than his master. There is no doubt at all that he drank an enormous amount. In fact, C.P. Scott said that Winston Churchill couldn't have been an alcoholic because no alcoholic could have drunk that much. Sometimes you see him at Marrakesh in 1943. He actually was getting over pneumonia and he drank white wine for breakfast, which is going it somewhat. However, what he basically did was to keep his blood alcohol level at a pretty much level all the way through until sort of 3 o'clock in the morning. But the important thing is that in the whole 2,194 days of the Second World War, there is only one day on which Winston Churchill got drunk. And everyone around him admitted that he was drunk, and he presided over a war cabinet meeting, and nothing happened as a result because everybody realised that the Prime Minister was drunk and just, you know. And so the next morning they came back to exactly the same decisions as though it hadn't happened. But how extraordinary, don't you think, ladies and gentlemen, that the incredible stress that man was under all the way through the Second World War, and he only actually got drunk once. If anything, I think it's a miracle of self-denial.
Mm. We've got to talk about something that's obviously at the centre of his life, which is his use of language, his oratory, his wit, and so on. And for a man of action, this is perhaps an unusual combination. Mm-hmm. Attlee said his main contribution to the war was talking about it. And I used to think there was something in that.
No, he did not say that. That's a gag.
Right. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, you if you read things like General Brooke's diaries, you get the impression that, you know, after 1940, Churchill is really rather a nuisance. He doesn't know what's going on. He's not really interested. But I think you show, it seems to me, first of all, his oratory is always at an equally high level, but also, which I admit I hadn't really realized, I should have known it, but his energy and his grasp of detail, his constant energizing of the whole war effort continues throughout. Is that how you would see it?
Absolutely. And what one has to do with Alan Brooks' diaries, which are a fantastic source, I mean, they are magnificent, is to factor in the fact that they were a pressure valve for him. He was undergoing these incredibly tough, hard meetings where Brooke would sit on one side of the table, Brooke being the chief of the Imperial General Staff and the chairman of the British Chiefs of Staff after 1942, March 1942, and Prime Minister would be sitting on the other, and Brooke would be sitting there breaking pencils in half, saying, "No, I disagree with you, Prime Minister." Must be very off-putting to have a 6-foot-2 flinty Ulsterman sitting across the table breaking pencils up. And so we can't take the Brooke diaries as being the last word when it comes to their relationship, because what they did together, this creative tension, and there's no doubt it was tension all the way through, but it was a creative tension, because what they did together was to forge the Mediterranean strategy. They then sold that to the Americans. They worked out the time for the ideal attack for D-Day across into France. And what they really created together was the strategy that won the war in the West. So Brooke does rant against Churchill, but he also says, in a key moment, he also says that he was thankful for having been there at the time, and that Winston Churchill reminded him that such supermen do exist on Earth.
Well, I think we should say something about, as I was saying, about part of his superman ability, which is his use of language. And as I think you show again, this is not accident. This is something that he carefully prepares. Could you tell us something about the sources of his literary
skill? Well, he was taught what he called that noble thing, the English sentence. And he was actually Winston Churchill was very much an autodidact. He was very much self-taught. He had to be because he went to Harrow. But he wrote the English, these wonderful English sentences, because he was broke all the time. He was financially broke because his parents were terrible spendthrifts. His father, of course, was the younger son and therefore got very little money. And he himself spent lavishly all his life. And was always teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. There were two times in the wilderness years in the 1930s when he had to put Chartwell up for sale. At no point did this mean that he was going to sack any of his 14 servants, nonetheless, because he had a very positive attitude, which was when you're broke, you earn more rather than try to save money. And so he did master this. He wrote 37 books. And from that, as well as these thousands of speeches that he gave up and down the country for 40 years before becoming Prime Minister, he worked out how audiences worked and how the radio worked, of course, as well. And so by the time he became Prime Minister in 1940, all his past life really genuinely had been a preparation for this hour and this trial. Oh, and also, sorry, one other thing. Of course, in the great speeches of the Second World War, he always concentrated on keeping words as short as possible and as Anglo-Saxon as possible. He did believe in the Old English. He thought that they were more powerful words. So, for example, in the paragraph of the "We Shall Fight on the Beaches" speech, which has, you know, "We shall fight with growing confidence in the air, and we shall never surrender," and that peroration of possibly the most famous speech in his life. If you look at those 141 words, all of them come from Old English, except for two, "confidence," which is Latin, and "surrender," which is French.
Well, You've shown you're capable of a Churchillian kind of repartee. we know.
Sorry, and Isabel, your wife, is in the audience.
And
she's French.
I'm a French citizen.
And you're a French citizen, so no, I know. Highly risky gag, that.
We know he prepared his great speeches very carefully and learned them by heart, did you not? But he was capable of improvising, too, very moving, as you show. And he was also, of course, a very good spontaneous wit. Could I say my two favourite jokes? One is...
I'll let you tell your two favourite if I tell my two favourite.
Well, one was in his young days when he was visiting Uganda, and he was told that there's an unfortunate spread of venereal disease among the natives, and he said, this is Pox Britannia. And the other one was much later. This was after the war, when a Labour MP called Paling shouted out, "You're a dirty dog," in the House of Commons, and he said the honourable gentleman should remember what dirty dogs do to palings.
Okay, you've done well on the clapometer, but I've got mine now. First one is, this is extraordinary, is the more perilous the situation for him and the country, the funnier his jokes got. This is also part of his sense of destiny. He knew that he was going to save London, the nation, and the empire, and so he was extraordinarily calm, even when day to day the invasion was expected. And during one of the confidence motions in the House of Commons, when at least theoretically his government could fall, he spoke, and he was being attacked for the A-22 tank, which simply didn't work. And he said, when the defects and teething troubles of the A-22 tank became apparent to all, it was appropriately rechristened the Churchill. But by the way, the key word there in that gag is appropriately, because he knew that he himself also had teething troubles and defects. He had got so many things wrong in his life. He had got the gold standard wrong, women's suffrage, the Dardanelles catastrophe, of course, the abdication crisis, all sorts of things. But he learnt from his mistakes. The great thing about him as a politician was that he was capable of learning from his mistakes. And the next gag is the one where Jock Colville, his private secretary, came to him and said that their cook had been made pregnant as the result of a nocturnal assignation with a man in the street in Verona. And Churchill immediately replied, "Not one of the two gentlemen?"
Well, I think maybe you win on the clapometer. I think there's something that we cannot not speak about. It's related to his sense of destiny, I think, which is his relationship with his father. Now, in many ways, he was a rebel, Churchill, it seems to me. Yeah. But he never rebelled against his father. Throughout his life, and this is, you show very movingly, he retained, even until old age, a great devotion to his father's memory. Now, why is that?
Even though his father had been a neglectful and disdainful and aloof presence in his life, who some of the most moving parts of this book are the letters from his father to Churchill, just so unpleasant and unfair as well. And yet, Winston Churchill, who was naturally magnanimous, never seems to have taken it personally. He was able to get beyond this, and in fact it was further than that. His father died when Winston Churchill was 20 years old, and yet for the rest of his life he seemed to be pretty much obsessed with his father. He wrote his father's biography. He sought out his father's friends. He quoted his father in speeches. He adopted his father's physical way of standing. He adopted all his father's political assumptions, which effectively the Tory Democrat ones that came from Benjamin Disraeli. He called his son Randolph. When basically Churchill, as I mentioned earlier, was broke all his life, when finally at the age of 71 he sold his war memoirs and came into huge amounts of money, the first thing he did was to buy 37 racehorses, and he dressed the jockeys in the pink and chocolate colours of his father's racehorses. He then, in 1947, had a rather weird moment which is fascinating psychologically, where he met his father's ghost in a dream, or at least not a sleeping dream, a sort of waking dream whilst he was painting. And he wrote about it in the dream, and I do recommend you, ladies and gentlemen, to read that as soon as you've read that, because it really is a fascinating aspect of the psychological effect that his father had on him.
It's a very subtle story, because his father in his dream does not know what his son has become, and his son Winston does not tell him. You could imagine a sort of wish fulfillment thing, which he says, you know, father, I've been prime minister, I've saved the world, and so on. He doesn't. He lets his father continue to think that he's done nothing.
Yes.
I think that's really extraordinary.
It is. Churchill actually, after the war, because of course his success had been so obvious to all, was tremendously modest about it. He didn't need to boast. It was there. I mean, in a sense, his six volumes of war memoirs set out the whole story for everybody. But he rather looked down on some of those commanders, Montgomery and Mountbatten, being the obvious examples, who constantly had to show off about what they'd done.
You quote him as saying, which seems to me a very good insight into his own character, "I'm arrogant but not conceited."
There is a difference.
Yes.
There is a huge difference, absolutely. I know this because I'm conceited and arrogant.
Well, I think we better move on. I should say I didn't find you either, Andrew. But now, you mentioned his Tory democracy. Trust the people is one of the phrases he uses, which he takes from his father. And, of course, the people trust him. Was there something wrong with the British establishment that meant that so many of them could not see Churchill's virtues, whereas ordinary people could?
He had made so many mistakes many of which were remembered much more by the establishment than by the people. And also, I think there might be just a sense that the establishment is much less forgiving than the people. But because the errors that he made were almost always made as a result of him being following what he truly believed. The Indian constitutional crisis, opposing home rule for India, was something that was epicentral to him because of his love of the empire. And people, although he was on the wrong side of history as far as that was concerned, people at least believed that he understood that he did this because of something he believed in. The same thing, of course, with appeasement and the way in which he came to oppose appeasement. There are three major aspects of this. His philo-Semitism. He was, unlike many of the people of his class and background, he liked Jews, and he got on with them. He went on holiday with them. His father had liked them. They were people who he respected and admired, which was not the case with an awful lot of people from his background. And he also was a great historian, of course, and had written the life of his great ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, whose victory in the War of Spanish Succession he was able to put into the overall historical panorama that goes from Philip II to the Kaiser via Napoleon and so on. And also, he understood fanaticism very closely. He had seen fanaticism up close in the Northwest Frontier and in the Sudan, and he spotted it again in the Nazis in a way that other people, like the Prime Ministers of the 30s, like Ramsay MacDonald and Stanley Baldwin and Neville Chamberlain, never really truly did. because they hadn't seen it in their own lives.
Yes. I think we're going to open this to the audience in a moment, but I'd like to ask you just one thing, or at least make a comment and see whether you agree with it. As you said, he admitted that he made a lot of mistakes, and he's associated with a good number of strategic, let's say, either disasters, Gallipoli, undeniably, and others which at least were seen at the time as disasters, Crete and Singapore, for example.
Norway.
But in the case of Crete and Singapore, it seems to me that he did this quite, I think you show this, if I understand you correctly. He knew the risks, and even afterwards he said, I would do this again, because in the case of Greece, it was necessary to show political support. In the case of Singapore, it was necessary to send aircraft, not to Singapore, but to Russia. And so he has a political and strategic view of the war, which many generals would not have, because of course they would think of it purely in terms of military and not of political priorities. Do you think that's
Clausewitzian in him?
Yes,
that is absolutely the Clausewitzian in him, both with Greece and as you say with Singapore. And so the people in the War Office, people like Major General John Kennedy. In his diaries, as of course with Alan Brooke to an extent as well, really criticised him for something that they weren't responsible for seeing the wider picture of the whole conflict, and so as a result, you get a very negative view of him amongst those soldiers in the War Office. I mean, of course, both of those things were catastrophic disasters militarily. But one can understand why he took those decisions. This is not, in any sense, as I say, he made endless mistakes. This is not in any sense a hagiography, this book. But I do try to point out what it was like to have sat in Churchill's yes. chair.
And I think you do that very effectively, because the amount of detail that you give gives us the impression of following day to day. Well, this is not a hagiography, as you rightly say, but I would like to end our discussion, if I might, by quoting your last couple of sentences, which I thought were rather beautiful, and then we'll pass over to the audience. If I may, you say...
Quote the whole paragraph while you're at it.
I don't want to keep the audience waiting too long. With enough spirit, he believed that we can rise above anything and create something truly magnificent of our lives. His hero, John Churchill, Duke of Marlborough, won great battles and built Blenheim Palace. His other hero, Napoleon, won even more battles and built an empire. Winston Churchill did better than either of them. The battles he won saved liberty.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have more than half an hour. If you want to continue for half an hour, for you to ask questions and for Andrew Roberts to answer them. So I can't see terribly well because the lights are quite bright. But there's a gentleman here, and
this lady will be taking. Yeah.
Oh yes, okay. Someone in the front row, and then someone just behind.
How much should he be blamed for the Bengal famine?
Ah, yes, this is a very topical issue, because only yesterday an astronaut called Scott Kelly, a very senior astronaut, he's actually called the UN ambassador to space. Only the United Nations, of course, would appoint an ambassador to somewhere that doesn't have a government or a people. was quoting Churchill, his great line in Victory in Magnanimity, and he got massively trolled by the anti-Churchill cyber warriors who denounced him for all sorts of things. And one of them, of course, was the Bengal famine, which they say he caused. Ladies and gentlemen, the Bengal famine. In October 1942, Bengal was hit by a massive, terrible cyclone, which destroyed the rice crop, and also which the Bengalis living in that area entirely depended on, and also the road and rail links that had hitherto brought food into that part of Bengal. In the past, it was the rice from Thailand and Malaya and Burma that was brought in to deal with these horrific famines that started immediately on this. In no case could that be possible of those three, for the simple reason that the Japanese controlled those areas and would not allow their rice to be sold to British India. You also had Japanese submarines in the Bay of Bengal, and eastern Indian cities had been bombarded by the Japanese Navy. Then you had the major problem, and I'm not for a moment denying that the Raj in New Delhi, but also the local, by that stage, Indian-dominated provincial governments prevented the sale of rice and tragically allowed the hoarding of rice by the merchants who owned it, because the prices, of course, were going up astronomically. You had a situation where the Bengal government could not buy rice from other provincial governments. This is something that the Viceroy should have dealt with, or maybe the Secretary of State for India should have dealt with. The idea that Winston Churchill deliberately attempted to commit genocide on millions of Bengalis just simply does not stack up. When I've gone to the papers, usually at the Churchill College archives in Cambridge, these papers, you see again and again Winston Churchill writing to the Viceroy, writing to the Secretary of State for India, writing to Franklin Roosevelt, asking for hundreds of thousands of tons of grain to be brought in, and getting no from certainly from Franklin Roosevelt. It is one of the great classic libels of Winston Churchill. It is something that this astronaut, if he had spent 5 minutes on the internet, could have actually looked up what the International Churchill Society say about this, what I've written many times about this, what many historians. Arthur Herman, the great American historian, says that the Bengal famine would have been far worse if it hadn't been for Churchill, and I think he's right. And instead of actually doing this, the astronaut just completely folded and capitulated to these trolls and said, "Oh, I'm sorry." His actual phrase was, "I didn't realise that the racist atrocities of Winston Churchill were so bad." You know, frankly, the only space that he really ought to concentrate is the space between his ears.
Firstly, thank you very much for a very both inspiring and witty conversation this evening. When you're the author of the 1,010th biography on Winston Churchill, how do you manage addressing the historiography that comes before you? And once you've finished, maybe finish your book on Churchill, what's next for you?
The way to do it, I think, and I've done the same thing 4 years ago with Napoleon, who had more books written about him, or at least books written with him in the title, than there were days since his death. is basically what you do is you choose what you think are the three or four best books on Churchill. I'm not going to mention them because some of them are still in print. then look at the books that were written, especially really early on. The first biography of Winston Churchill was written in 1905 when he was 30 years old. And so that in itself just shows what a sort of protean figure they already thought that he was. And so what you do is to look at those ones, the early ones, and you pretty much ignore 90% of everything that was published since his death in 1965. Otherwise, you'd go mad, or it would take you your whole life. And then you concentrate then on primary sources. And I don't mean just the published secondary sources. I mean, you go to, in my case, I think this book took me to 50 archives and 168 people's papers. And that's the place where you're going to get the new stuff, the interesting stuff. The great thing about these new sources that I mentioned earlier is that they mean that on pretty much every page of this book, there is something that will not have appeared in a Churchill biography before. As far as my next book is concerned, any ideas? I don't come up with my own ideas for books, I've noticed, in my life. Stuart Proffitt, who's in the audience here, my publisher, he's come up with a couple of ideas. My father has, my agent has, my previous publisher has, my first wife, which was rather nerve-wracking after we got divorced, came up with a brilliant idea, in fact. And I'm just not very good at it myself. So if anyone's got a brilliant idea, do let me know. Gentleman here? Sorry, there's a microphone there.
You mentioned towards the end of your most entertaining talk that you brought it up to date by talking about his trusting the people and spotting fanaticism. What do you think he would spot in today's circumstances, and what do you think he would make of it all?
Do you know, I really do try to... He died over 50 years ago, so I am not. I follow what his daughter Mary Soames said, which is that one can't play the game of what would Winston do. It's so easy to do that, and I go out of my way not to. Constantly. yes. Yeah. That doesn't matter.
Thank you. So to what extent did Churchill's confidence in British imperial power was dampened after the surrender at Singapore? And did he fully appreciate not just how disastrous it was in terms of a strategic point of view, but how it shattered the way in which Britain was then viewed throughout the rest of the empire?
Yes, that's a very good question. He didn't appreciate that, no. And it's totally concentrated his energies, because he's carried on believing in the empire. Of course, after the fall of Singapore, he still, in the November of 1942, said that he had not become the King's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. British Empire was something that he had given his life to, he had taken risks for, he had actually put before his own political best interests. And he felt that the best way to deal with the Japanese capture of Singapore was to capture it back. And so he supported the Bay of Bengal strategy when his chiefs of staff preferred to follow the American Pacific strategy. And this led to a huge clash. In March 1944, the chiefs of staff were on the verge of all simultaneously resigning. And part of the, I think it's chapter 30 of my book, is about this amazing moment. It's a sort of existential crisis for the British government, which way they go. And Churchill was insistent on it being a war to re-establish the British Empire, which of course was incredibly short-sighted ultimately. Gentleman in the front here.
You mentioned his relationship with the King, which I found fascinating, and what the King thought of him. But could you just tell us a little bit about the King, how useful he was and how much he knew?
Well, the King was consulted by Churchill. I think that almost the nearest, without laissez-majesté, the nearest metaphor might be the king acted as Winston Churchill's shrink. These weekly audiences where they would serve themselves from the sideboard because the servants couldn't be present because what they were discussing was so secret, allowed Churchill to vent. He vented about the Americans on a number of occasions, things to do with the positions of the ships at Pearl Harbor, for example, and the idiocies of various bottlenecks of production. He vented against the House of Commons, which constantly were holding these votes of confidence to try to unseat Churchill. He vented about various members of his cabinet, and he also vented about various people in the colonial administration, and the king sat there and listened and gave him good advice, encouraged and warned in the way that Bagehot said monarchs should, and luckily also wrote down everything that Winston Churchill said, which means that that this book has got lots of brand new information. But it was a symbiotic thing, because Churchill also very much admired the way the King and the Queen went around the country to bomb-damaged cities and talked to ordinary people and got a sense of what the British people were thinking and saying. And so he got back from the King almost as much as he was giving to the King, and it was therefore a really important relationship in his political makeup. One of the, that there's lady there, perhaps, or...
One gentleman there.
Or gentleman
over here.
Thank you.
And the lady here, yes.
I'm looking forward very much to reading your book. I haven't read any of it yet, of course. Is it true that Churchill was prevented from using chemical weapons by the generals in the British Army?
No, it wasn't. There's a huge... this is also goes back to a lot of the trolling issues that we've got in cyberspace, where they again and again say that Churchill wanted to use poison gas against the Iraqi tribesmen. Actually, if you go to Churchill College, Cambridge, and you look at the original sources, the letter from Churchill, he makes it quite clear. He actually says the word lacrimatory gas, meaning tear gas. Ladies and gentlemen, using tear gas against somebody is completely different from using phosgene or mustard or chlorine gas. And so it can't be equated one with the other. As far as the Second World War is concerned, Churchill was going to, and the Chiefs of Staff agreed with him, that if the Germans landed, the beaches were going to be completely covered in gas. And we were going to use actual poison gas on the beaches of Britain in order to try to stymie the invasion. And that's something the Chiefs of Staff supported. There were also some discussions about whether or not if the Nazis used poison gas, whether or not we would respond with it. And the decision ultimately was taken that we would confer with the Russians and the Americans before we did. Sir, just shout. Here it is, sorry.
Sorry, if I could just cheat quickly. The first question is relates to the new information that you found from George VI's diaries. I wondered whether you'd heard anything from the Queen herself in relation to her relationship with Churchill. And secondly, any new insights on the relationship Churchill had with FDR and Stalin?
Yes, with regard to the Queen, I have not written to the Queen to ask, not least because she was born in 1926, and although she was... I think if she had had a relationship with Winston Churchill during the war, at least, we'd know about it. And after the war, it's something that we'll find out about when her diaries are published long after everybody in this room is dead. With regard to FDR and Stalin, yes, there's an enormous amount. He speaks to the king very openly about his about the positive and negative aspects of his relationship with FDR, and it also seems fairly clear that Stalin that what he was saying to the king was the same as he said to the cabinet when he came back from the Yalta conference, which was that although he personally doubted very much whether Stalin was telling the truth when he said that he was going to respect the integrity and independence of Poland, it was completely impossible without American help to do anything else than take the stance that they did. But yes, he was constantly talking to the king about both of these people, and everything of importance that he said in those diaries is in this book. Maybe the gentleman is just.
Thank you. I wanted to ask whether, when you embarked on this work, you knew that you were going to have some of these new materials. I ask this because I happened by chance only to have got round to reading a Roy Jenkins biography last year, and emblazoned on the front cover, I think it says something like, in a paperback version, a quote from yourself saying, "It will be a very foolhardy biographer who tackled this subject again for at least a decade, possibly for much longer." Now, it is 17 years ago, admittedly, but I wondered whether it was whether you were just foolhardy and then were lucky, or whether you actually knew before you set out that you would have these new sources, which clearly are, apart from obviously the different style and different insight, seem to be a great appeal of tackling yet another mammoth biography of Churchill, in my case, say, soon after reading the previous one.
Pure hubris. Next question. This gentleman here.
You mention and talk about Churchill's reverence for his father and how he adopted his political positions. What about the influence of his mother?
Yes, that's a very good question as well. She, of course, was considered the most beautiful woman in England, in high society in England. She had affairs with several people who, including, of course, the Prince of Wales. She was a fascinating and gorgeous woman who showed virtually no interest whatsoever in either of her sons whatsoever until they were in their 20s. She led a very active social life. When I looked at her 1884 diary, when she was when Winston Churchill was 10 years old, she mentions the 40 times that she went to various social events in a particular month, and all the times that she went to the balls and the parties and the tea with Arthur Balfour and any number of lovers that she had and the rest. And she mentioned her children, having met her children on two occasions over. Actually, if you add them all up together, it's 13 occasions in 6 months, sometimes for half an hour. And yet, in his autobiography, My Early Life, he says of his mother that she shone for me like the evening star, brilliant but at a distance. And this was not totally unusual in amongst Edwardian families. Of course, children were seen and not heard, but nonetheless, it cannot have been anything other than extremely painful for him to have been separated from his mother. And then, when they became close later on in life, she then died, and he had mother substitutes in his governess, Elizabeth Everett, and in his grandmother, the Duchess of Marlborough. But it wasn't really until he met Clementine, his wife, that he had a proper relationship with a woman who loved him.
Several people over this side.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry. Yes. How about some of these? What about that gentleman there?
The gentleman here in the. Yes, there he is.
Can't quite see him, but there we are.
Hello, Andrew. Sorry, it's George Trefgarne here.
Hello, George.
What I wanted to ask was, you said that Churchill was always stood up for the British Empire, but what the British Empire was went through numerous iterations through, you know, its lifespan, and including through his lifespan, whether it was an informal empire, formal empire, free trade zone, protectionist zone. What was his rationale of empire, and what particularly led him to stand up for it?
Yes. When Winston Churchill was standing on the northwest frontier defending the empire or fighting for the empire, he of course didn't have the great advantages that we have now of knowing, since the 1960s Marxist view, that it was a terrible imperialist and evil exploitative concept. He, for some reason, thought that the fact that the empire had brought the longest period of internal peace in India, in the history of India, and the fact that it had extended life expectancy in India by 50%, and that it had increased the amount of land under cultivation through irrigation by 8 times, and the fact that it had given the English language and the railways and the viaducts and the rule of law and abolished sati and tuggy, and the fact that it had really created an internal free trade market and had protected the Indians from Russian, French, Spanish, Portuguese empires and other things like that. Really, he thought that was going to be a good thing for Indians. So, unfortunately, he laboured under this terrible, terrible delusion that the British Empire never did anything we simply can't get back into the minds of the imperialists of the late 19th century. But when we try to, I think it isn't difficult to understand why Winston Churchill was willing to give his life for this concept. It was something that was considered to be the best thing that Britain had ever given the world in the history of Britain, and it didn't have these negative connotations which our brilliant Marxist historians give it today.
Could you say a bit about his political life after the war? I mean, he very much opposed the socialist program of the Labour government of 45, but he didn't seem to do very much to reverse it when he came into government in 1951. He's widely thought to have been very supportive of the concept of European federalism, and there are sort of two views as to whether or not he thought the UK should be part of it. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Although in the 1945 general election, made the terrible mistake, of course, of equating the Labour policies with the Gestapo in a speech. A completely and utterly absurd remark to make. One of his classic examples of extravagances of language, which he adopted all the way through his life, really. When he actually came to power in 1951, with a majority of 17, so a workable majority, he considered that his job really was, as he put it, housing, meat, and not getting scuppered. And he did okay with housing, built a million council houses. He did ration by the time he left office, and he wasn't scuppered. In fact, the Conservatives won the 1955 and 1959 general elections. But it wasn't really a great a great reforming ministry. He was 80 by then. He was pretty deaf. There was a massive hearing aid that was put in the middle of the cabinet table. He didn't use his Action This Day labels any longer. And I think that period of the 51-55 ministry was something of a wasted opportunity for Britain. And he missed any opportunity because he was such a fighter. He wanted to carry on as long as he possibly could. So he didn't resign at the time of the coronation. He didn't resign at the time of his stroke in July 1953. He didn't resign at his 80th birthday in November 1954. With regard to the European issue, he had been a leader, a giant of the European movement. He had been the first person really to say, let Europe unite, in his own words. He had been a true believer in ensuring that, in his words, Teuton did not fight Gaul. But he had deliberately used language that implied that that Britain was going to be part of this. But actually, when you look at the language he used, where he said that Britain was going to be a friend, an ally, a supporter, they were all, never went actually so far as to say member. And what he did during the 51 to 55 ministry was not to move at all towards the European army concept or the iron and steel confederation concept, and a lot of really important, serious and substantial European movement federalists like Lord Gladwin Jebb from the Foreign Office, were deeply disappointed by the way in which Winston Churchill did not follow up with actions what he had seemed to promise in opposition with words. That lady there, can we ask, give a mic? We don't want to carry on.
Hello. I would like to ask, you title your book Walking with Destiny. Do you think that Churchill himself, at various points in his career, was aware that he was forging arguably one of the most successful destinies of any British Prime Minister? And what do you think he would make of us sitting here tonight talking about the 1010th book on his life?
He would love it. he'd absolutely love the idea that we were still talking about him. I think one of the things about his sense of destiny, and it's a very good question, was the sheer number of times that he had nearly died in his life. Up there, you can see, just above his forehead, above his nose, in between his eyes, that livid scar. Can you see it, ladies and gentlemen? I hope so. That huge, great scar there, which you can also buy in the book that you're yearning to buy. That is the scar that he got in December 1931, when he was so nearly killed in a car crash on the on Fifth Avenue in New York. But then go back a bit and see the time when he was 10 years old and he got stabbed in the stomach, and the time that he nearly died of pneumonia, and all of these extraordinary moments in his life where he nearly died. He was absolutely driven by this sense of destiny, and. Again, although we might not believe in it, and it might not make any kind of theological sense to us, it did to him, and that's what mattered. Gentleman in the middle.
Hello, Andrew. It's Boo. Very good to hear you.
Hiya, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Hi, Laura.
Andrew, you've written, obviously, about some amazing people in history. Has it been tempting for you to make those comparisons between the personalities and the characteristics and their sort of behavioural traits? And if so, what are they? And if not, do you feel that Churchill was just very much a complete one-off?
Actually, funnily enough, that's a very good question. I think that I did see in the course of writing this book a lot of behavioural traits in common with Napoleon, who was his hero, of course. Churchill had a Napoleon bust on his table all the way through his life. He constantly quoted from Napoleon. In my view, one of the saddest things about Churchill is that he never wrote the biography that he was planning of Napoleon. And there are a large number of behavioural traits. The most important one, I think, was his capacity for compartmentalisation of his life. Churchill, like Napoleon, was able to concentrate entirely on whatever was in front of him at the time, to the exclusion of everything else, and then move on to the next thing, which I don't know whether or not it's a sign of great men in general, or whether or not it's a sign of monomania of some kind. But it really is important for both of those people. And so it helped me enormously to write the life of Napoleon before the life of Churchill. I'm glad it was that way round rather than the other way around, as it were, because so much of Churchill's life was a conscious attempt to be better than Napoleon, and you see it again and again with his speeches and his references and his library. In Churchill College, Cambridge, there is an enormous Napoleon library that belonged to Churchill, and he had it all specially bound and kept in a particular part of Chartwell. Napoleon really mattered to him, and if you're looking for somebody who is quite as egomaniacal as Napoleon, you really do have to go back to Winston Churchill. One more question, I think, perhaps, before...
Yes, one more. I think the gentleman in the middle.
Yes. There's a microphone just coming towards you, which will help everybody to hear.
Yeah, I think Churchill was one of the very earliest to identify our former allies, the Soviets, as the growing threat. And, of course, the Cold War continued for quite some years beyond Churchill's death. What impact did that Cold War that lived beyond Churchill's life have on him when he reflected on his achievements in the 50s and early 60s?
Well, interestingly, when he reflected on... the Cold War was something that he hoped and thought that he was going to be able to resolve. One of the reasons that he stayed in power for so long, not just being able to keep out Anthony Eden or stay in office for as long as he possibly could and beat all the records, he actually did believe that he was going to be able to bring a settlement to the Cold War. And it was impossible because he didn't have the cabinet behind him, he didn't have the foreign secretary behind him, he didn't have the Americans behind him. It was not going to happen. In a way, it might even have been an excuse for staying in power. However, he was... And after 1949, when the Soviets tested their nuclear weapon, he entirely changed his view over the Soviet Union and went from being extreme hawkish to extreme dove. And when one looks at his attitude towards the Soviet Union, which, of course, right at the beginning, he wanted to try to strangle Bolshevism in its cradle. And then after that, he made friends with the Soviet Union on the 22nd of June 1941 at the time of Operation Barbarossa. Then he became anti-Soviet at the time of his great Iron Curtain speech. And then he wanted to have another friendly relation with Russia after they had exploded the nuclear bomb. He's accused, as he is so often, ladies and gentlemen, throughout his life, of being opportunistic. But there is a central thread through all of this, which is British national interest. And you can see that also, of course, at the time of the Nazi-Soviet Pact and everything to do with that as well. He did try to put the country first. And that is one of the reasons that when you factor in everything else about him, his foresight, his courage, this extraordinary courage that meant that he, both physical courage, the 110,000 miles that he travelled outside the United Kingdom during the Second World War, but also his moral courage in standing up against the Nazis and then the communists. His eloquence, this extraordinary eloquence as well. It seems to me that the combination is something that historically has always been important, always will be important, and is probably never needed more than today. Thank you very much indeed.